Earlier this month, it was exciting to see the U.S. Supreme Court make two important decisions that impact millions of people in this country under direct threat from the Trump administration. In rulings that took many by surprise, the justices unambiguously affirmed nationwide non-discrimination on the job as a fundamental right for LGBTQI+ persons. They then blocked a wholesale disruption of the popular DACA program, which did so much during the Obama administration to reduce fear and uncertainty among millions of undocumented young people, the Dreamers. After years of seemingly unrelenting moves in the wrong direction, it's heartening to see that progress and continued holding of a line is still possible. Now, for those who have lost hope, I wanted to highlight some other ongoing efforts at moving our government and our courts in the right direction. And joining me now is Catherine Joseph, Director of Policy and Advocacy at Interfaith Alliance. She's been doing a great job. Katie, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Walden. It's great to be with you.
I really think it's essential to highlight the successes that the movement for greater justice and inclusion is having, because so many of the headlines are so dark these days. I know that there are a lot of important initiatives the Alliance and its partners are working on. And I'd like for you just to start with the one that's taking the most of your time right now, if you would. Have at it.
Well, I'll be honest, Walton, the excitement and the surprise from the Supreme Court's decisions around LGBTQ employment and DACA are still carrying me through these days. You are entirely right that it is very easy right now, in a real moment of crisis, in a moment of very painful transition for our country, to feel like each day is incredibly, incredibly difficult. And yet we have these bright moments and reminders that as it said, the arc of history bends toward justice. So as we're continuing our work to ensure that all people are treated equally under law, and that religion is not used as a means to undermine the rights of others or to cause harm, we're continuing to remain active around this question of public health and what it means, particularly for faith communities, to be navigating the coronavirus crisis at a time when so many of us feel the need to be in community with one another. It feels very, very isolating still. Here we are 3-4 months into this lockdown, shelter in place, slow reopening process, to, for many of us, still feel very disconnected from that source of strength and of hope that our faith communities provide. But of course, at the same time, regardless of your tradition and where you are in the country right now in that reopening process, we need to make sure that we are coming together when it's safe to do so. And so there has been a tremendous amount of activity that we've been a part of around these public health restrictions that impact what can reopen and when. In particular, how religious institutions may be limited in their capacity or their ability to assemble under public health orders in comparison to secular institutions, businesses, and essential services.
Katie, talk about the real life implications of what we're working on. Who are the people who would be most directly affected by a successful outcome of what you're working on?
we've seen reports as states are beginning to reopen of instances where perhaps some places are moving too fast. And we're seeing, unfortunately, a spike in coronavirus cases. And there was a really heart-wrenching story out of the state of Oregon just a couple weeks ago about a church in Union County that at the end of May came together for in-person worship services, hosted a wedding, a graduation service inside. Folks were singing. You know, if your congregation is anything like mine, folks are shaking hands, they're giving hugs. They're close together. And after folks spent that time together in worship, 236 people in that congregation tested positive for coronavirus. And that is frightening. And a real concern, not just for that congregation, for the community that they're a part of, for the state of Oregon. And so as we're thinking through and participating in litigation around this reopening process, we need to think about both in terms of public health restrictions, in terms of the law, what makes sense in protecting public safety, and also as faith communities, as people who care about one another and who are invested in our collective survival and thriving, the choices that we make to ensure that we can get to the other side of this together.
Just so people understand the breadth of what you're interested in and what Interfaith Alliance is working on, what are maybe two other action areas in the same way? Who are you working with? Who do you keep in your mind's eye as you do the work? Just a brief look at that.
So there's been, I think, a very effective framing in terms of this moment that we're really dealing with twin crises. There's the coronavirus crisis, and then there's the ongoing crisis around racial justice and violent policing. And we've seen so many folks, many faith leaders, as well as civil rights organizations and activists around the country coming out to say there is a risk to public health right now, but there is a deeper systemic problem that needs to be handled right now. And that is this question around racial justice, and particularly the tragic and disproportionate impact on Black communities that policing and other forms of state violence have inflicted. And so we're working very closely in support of our partners in the civil rights community to ensure that we are not just taking this moment to do what's easy, what's top level, but to really dig down and start to do some of that really hard reparative work. Because everyone is not equal under the law when the law is simply applied neutrally. There are some deeper problems there that are still deeply impacting the folks we love and the folks who we organize with and have an obligation to solve.
Yeah. The breakthroughs I mentioned at the start of this conversation happened at the Supreme Court. There's been a lot of justifiable concern about the kinds of judges the Trump administration has been appointing all over the country. Would you talk about how significant that really is and whether we're seeing the kind of wholesale shift to the right that many are warning about?
So there's this kind of what's become a trope of the role of a judge to call balls and strikes. But I think while you and I both know that we all bring to the work that we do our own perspectives, our own experiences, and in many cases our implicit biases. And the position of a federal judge is one that really holds lives in their hands. And the impact that we're seeing on the federal judiciary to enshrine a particular ideology that does tend to affirm many practices that do not defend the least among us, that do not stand up for justice. It is deeply, deeply disturbing. And I think that this will be a project to undo that harm that will go on for decades.
Yeah. Katie, you've been on the show now several times, and there's one question I haven't ever asked you, and I'm going to ask that one now. What brought you to Interfaith Alliance? What did you think you could accomplish there?
I think about this question of what interfaith work looks like a lot. And I think that for me, my own religious identity as a Jewish person, as the child of a rabbi, living and working and doing this work in a society where a particular Christian voice often is dominant and is defined as the norm, has sparked in me an obligation to ensure that we don't allow that kind of normative idea of what it means to be a person of faith in the United States to foreclose the opportunity for people of all faith and of no faith to believe as they choose, as they are guaranteed under the First Amendment, and to do so without fearing discrimination or harassment.
Well, I'm glad you're there. Listen, usually I only ask Interfaith Alliance President Jack Moline to encourage listeners to join the Alliance and to support its work. But this time, I'd like to invite you to do that. And in particular, what would you like to be able to do more of if the resources were available that would benefit all Americans?
Well, I don't need to tell you that this election year will be a transformative one. And the question of what that transformation looks like is really up to us in the next 6 months or so. And so Interfaith Alliance this month has launched a new campaign called Your Vote, Your Values, to uplift people of faith, organizers, advocates who are doing the work to advance a brighter future. You know, so often this idea of what it means to vote your values is tied to a very particular religious and ideological perspective. But we know that many people of faith across the ideological spectrum vote their values for all kinds of reasons. And whether those values are rooted in economic justice, environmental justice, racial justice, those issues are on the line this year. And Interfaith Alliance is working to ensure that those perspectives and those movements are leading the charge as we head into November. So I invite all of your listeners on State of Belief to learn more about the Your Vote, Your Values campaign, to think deeply and together with those you love and in your community about what your values are and how you can ensure that those values become a reality with your vote this fall.
Catherine Joseph is Director of Policy and Advocacy at Interfaith Alliance, protecting true religious freedom for all. Katie, you're doing good work. Thanks so much for taking the time on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Walton. It was a pleasure.